You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a new partnership to train pharmacists, another report about offshore wind energy, and an update on a Coos Bay hospital. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
I'm Roma Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
Justin, you reported on an update to Bay Area Hospital, which is in Coos Bay. What's the news there?
Yeah, so the legislature passed something to really help this hospital out. And it's pretty unique. So rather than just give the hospital money, you know, a bill to actually give the hospital $10 million has failed before. This bill puts up $44 million as a loan guarantee. And so with that loan guarantee for the hospital, it cannot default on its current loan and then hopefully refinance its debts so it can be in a better position in the future. And that's a really novel way for that legislators figured out to help Bay Area. So to get the money for the guarantee, the state will use revenue from interest on unclaimed state property. And that money is usually reserved for education. So some legislators fought against that proposal. They didn't like taking money from education there. It barely passed. It was interesting, though, a Portland area Democrat, Representative Rob Nose, joined Southern Oregon Republicans to support the bill. So there was some across-the-aisle efforts there. And if the hospital does default, though, the state must pay back the lender. So there is some risk there. But right now, Coos Bay residents are really celebrating this bill.
And just to clarify, the state's not really spending the money right now. It's only if the hospital can't pay that loan.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Well, the loan was a big problem for Bay Area Hospital. Can you talk about the financial troubles at this hospital?
Yeah, it really started when the hospital took out this huge loan years ago. They borrowed $47 million from a Canadian bank to update their IT services. And then COVID happened, and the hospital's finances kind of became shakier. The hospital's actually been able to make their monthly payments on this loan, but the problem was that the loan agreement specified the hospital had to have $50 million in cash reserves. So I guess the lender would feel comfortable about lending that. And Bay Area, they couldn't do that. So there was a point where the lender could have asked for what's called a balloon payment, which is basically just a large lump sum payment on that loan. And then for the hospital to be able to do that, it would have had to sell off a bunch of assets and then reduce services. The risk was that they would have to go down to 50 beds compared to 170 beds that they have now. And that has to do with different Medicaid reimbursements, depending on the size of the hospital. It gets kind of confusing there. But residents really didn't want a reduction of service services at the hospital. The closest other major hospitals hours away, so either in Medford or Eugene. So this was a pretty important issue for people.
And you've reported on public efforts to save this hospital before.
Yeah, there's this mother and daughter team in Coos Bay who have been lucky enough to visit before and interview a bunch of times. But they've really been advocating for the hospital to continue running at the current level of services for a while. They organize community meetings and get people to go to hospital board meetings and financial meetings, which residents usually don't go to. And that interest really first started because there was a potential deal for a private equity firm to start operating Bay Area. And those kinds of companies are known for gutting services and maximizing profits. So this mother and daughter team, they fought against that. And it was really because of community pushback that a new hospital board was elected last year. And that deal fell through. And now with this lifeline through the state, people, I think, are finally breathing a sort of sigh of relief that this major hospital will continue serving people in this area.
Okay. Thanks, Justin. Jane, you reported this week on a new pathway for college students in Oregon interested in careers as a pharmacist. Tell us about that.
So briefly, Umpqua Community College in Roseburg, and then it also affects Chemeketa Community College in Salem, have created this new partnership with Pacific University to basically streamline the process so that students who are interested in working as a pharmacist have an easier pathway to get their advanced degree.
Okay, so streamlining, tell us how that actually works.
So basically, students can take their pre-pharmacy coursework, normal coursework at UCC or Chemeketa, get their associate's degree, and then they can go right to Pacific University to start their Doctor of Pharmacy degree. They have 3 or 5 year pathways for that there. So depending on if you want to be working full time or, you know, what students have going on, they can pick either of those pathways. And so I talked to a dean at Umpqua Community College who said, obviously, the sort of pre-pharmacy coursework already existed at UCC. That part is sort of business as usual. But this is a new pathway, a clear pathway with connections directly to Pacific University. And that part makes that process a lot easier for students to just go straight there and go from getting your associate's to getting your doctorate degree. And students will also have access to Pacific University's resources even while they're at UCC. So things like the financial aid office or the program director or the advising team if you have questions. So it's set up with the goal to basically make it easier for students to transition from undergraduate at UCC or Chemeketa to your advanced degree, getting your Doctor of Pharmacy at Pacific University. And that program is currently accepting applications if we have any listeners who are interested.
Well, what is the goal? Of course, it's, you know, to train pharmacists, but is there a larger goal there?
Sure. So there is a real workforce shortage in this field and in healthcare too in general. There was a press release that was sent out by Pacific, and they were saying that more than 200 pharmacies have closed in Oregon since 2008, and they predict there'll be a nationwide shortage of almost 5,000 pharmacists in about 10 years. So there is a need for more pharmacists in general. And then talking to this dean at UCC, he was saying the goal is also for students to return to Douglas County to complete their clinical rotations there. So that's kind of a personal goal for them. They want kids to come back and to work in their hometowns. They're trying to really keep that talent local in sort of a rural county, sort of an under-resourced county. He claimed that 3 out of every 4 students in the country who move away from their hometown for education stay away and don't come back, don't go home again. And so his goal is to have all of the clinical options that students need in Douglas County so they can go up to Hillsborough, get their advanced degree, and then come back and bring their talent home to work there and provide services in Douglas County. So that is their personal hope as well with this pathway.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Jane. And Justin, let's go back to you for a minute. You also reported on new lawsuits in Josephine County involving former commissioners. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of lawsuits, it seems, involving this county government lately. But the latest involves a couple former department heads. So the former public health director and the former community development director have each filed $1.5 million lawsuits against the county and then a bunch of former commissioners and one current commissioner. And they claim that they were retaliated against for participating in an ethics investigation against a former commissioner, John West. So the lawsuit's a whistleblower retaliation suit. And for some background, so Commissioner West faced 8 ethics investigations during his tenure, so quite a few. All were dismissed, though, by the State Investigations Board. But those complaints dealt with violating public meetings law and also using his position to benefit his personal businesses. He has a number of personal businesses. So these department heads say they assisted in one of these investigations. They claim they saw wrongdoing on West's behalf, and after that they were fired. So West is also out of a job. He was recalled in 2024, but there was a lot of interesting bits in these complaints that we reported on. Besides West and the county, the lawsuit also names former commissioners Herman Bertschiger, Andreas Black, and Chris Barnett, as well as current commissioner Ron Smith.
Okay, well, what else did you see in this lawsuit?
So besides being fired, they say they were harassed and bullied and faced defamation from commissioners. For example, one complaint alleges that commissioners spread a rumor that the health director had lied about his grandmother's death after he requested a bereavement leave. Mm. The community development director says he was denied actually a request to attend jury duty. So, you know, they also bring up a third-party investigation into workplace behavior by the commissioners. This report isn't public, so I can't say exactly what's in it, but the complaint alleges that this third-party investigation found evidence of bullying and harassment against employees. And so they bring that up in the complaint. And, you know, like I've mentioned, there's been a lot of lawsuits involving Josephine County. So we followed a series of defamation lawsuits involving West and Chris Barnett, former commissioner Barnett.
And sometimes they're the ones claiming they're being defamed.
Right, right. It goes both ways, yeah. So those commissioners actually won their cases, their defamation cases for hundreds of thousands of dollars against a news website owner or operator. So lots of lawsuits going on. And last year, actually, a former Josephine County secretary filed a federal lawsuit claiming she was also fired after raising ethical concerns over commissioner conduct. So her complaint looks somewhat similar to this latest one.
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on there, and we'll try to keep track of it all. Last but certainly not least, Roman, you reported on a national report about offshore wind on the West Coast. Where did this report come from?
Yeah, it was created by this committee of people from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. It's this like private institution created by Congress under President Abraham Lincoln all the way back in 1863 to essentially provide advice on science and technology issues. So they basically get these requests from Congress to research certain topics and then make the findings available to everyone. So this report came out this week and was specifically commissioned by Congress in 2023 to look at issues related to offshore wind development and on the West Coast. It kind of brought together a lot of different people from the industry and the region and tribes and all this sort of stuff to look at things that Congress was interested in looking at.
So what exactly does the report cover?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because it's sort of like a big hodgepodge of like all different things related to West Coast offshore wind and energy in general. You know, it was sort of like Congress wanted to look at these things. And so they're like, okay, we're going to have you work with all of these different stuff just to give us a big old report on all of these things. So it looks at one is impacts on fisheries, including how, you know, wind turbines may impact upwelling or disrupt access for fishing boats. Upwelling, for people to know, is on the West Coast specifically, there's cold water underneath that's nutrient rich, and the wind that blows across the water will drive that cold, nutrient-rich water up to the surface, and that is what creates a really good fishing ground on the West Coast. And so the wind turbines physically do pull the wind out of the ecosystem, and so it's kind of looking at how that might impact things. They also looked at impacts to rescue operations by the Coast Guard. You know, the Coast Guard, if they have to do rescues, often they'll fly helicopters really close to the water to rescue people, and these wind turbines could make that more difficult. They also looked at the planning and leasing process by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. They're the ones who actually lease areas off the ocean for offshore wind development and looking at how that can be improved. The report also doesn't just cover offshore wind. It also it really was technically a offshore energy, renewable energy report. So it looks at other types of renewable energy like wave energy. But usually offshore wind is kind of the one people are looking at when they're building right now. Wave energy isn't as big of a market at this point.
Why are they focusing just on the West Coast?
Yeah, they're looking at the West Coast because there really hasn't been anything done on the West Coast yet in terms of offshore wind. There's been some plans in California, but, you know, there's nothing that's really been built yet. The East Coast, there are a couple of wind turbines and more efforts there, but it's also just very different. On the West Coast, the coastline or the ocean bed just drops off really rapidly, and so it's much deeper over here than on the East Coast. So on the East Coast, they're building the turbines straight into the ground on the ocean floor, but on the West Coast, they're all going to be floating. So it's very different, have different impacts, and the marine industry is also different over here.
Okay. Well, what did the commission find?
Yeah, they found a lot of stuff. I mean, turns out it's definitely going to impact these fisheries. A lot of types of fishing boats aren't going to be able to operate within the wind farms because they're just too close together. They also talked about, you know, East Coast efforts to provide compensation to fishers who might be impacted. There was also a lot of talk, and I talked with the creators of this report about the leasing process. BOEM was going to lease some areas off of Oregon, but they canceled that auction after most of the developers backed out. And they also faced a lot of pushback from the community and the state. And this report kind of debriefed that whole process. And they basically found that people felt their responses weren't being considered. It was really one-sided. And their recommendations were that BOEM work with other agencies like the Coast Guard or NOAA in the future because they're better at building trust with these communities. And, you know, BOEM kind of usually just comes in and leaves, so they haven't had as much contact.
And quickly, you know, the Trump administration has paused future offshore wind development. How relevant is this report?
Yeah, it didn't affect things that much. They're really kind of looking at the future of how to prepare for when a new administration is more favorable and what they can do to prepare for that in the meantime.
Okay, thank you, Roman. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. You can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.